The case we're going to look at now comes from 11th century France. I'm John Hudson, and with me, to tell me about it, I have Matt McAfee. So, could you tell me the date of this particular case and where it's happening?
So this case takes place in Western France, and it dates to between 1097 or 1098. It's not entirely clear when. And it happened in a court at Châteaudun, which is presided over by Adela, the formidable Countess of Blois, who was also the daughter of William the Conqueror. And it took place when Adela's husband, Count Stephen, was off in the Holy Land with the First Crusade.
And who are the parties to the dispute?
So we know that the plaintiff seems to have been a monk named Yves, and he was in charge of the priory of Saint-Hilaire, which was a priory belonging to the monks of Marmoutier. And the defendant was Hugh, the Viscount of Châteaudun, and a fairly major political player in the region.
And Yves is a monk of Marmoutier?
Yes, yes.
And what's the issue involved in the dispute?
So the issue here was that Hugh had seized property belonging to the monks and collected a year's worth of revenues from this property. It's not clear on what grounds Hugh had claimed the disputed property. The monks said that they had acquired this over 10 years earlier from a man named Geoffrey Freslevena and his family. We do know from some of the earlier charters recording the monks' acquisition of this, that this property was explicitly, or sorry, a part of this property had been explicitly identified as a fief that supported three knights. An educated guess, therefore, might be that Hugh enjoyed or claimed some degree of lordship over the property, and the dispute between him and the monks concerned who had the right to exercise this lordship. But this is, of course, speculative.
Now, one of the difficulties with looking at particularly early cases is often we know a lot about the issue and sometimes about the outcome, but can we find anything out about procedure?
Yes and no. In short, very little is said about procedure. But we do know that there were two judgments in this case, one addressing what we would now identify as the possessory issue, and the other addressing what we would identify as the proprietary issue. And these were treated by the court in two separate judgments. So the court first judged on Hugh's act of dispossession, and only then did Hugh, and I think it's important that it was Hugh, asked the court to consider his claim against the monks for what we would think of as the proprietary issue. And following this request for a judgment on the issue of ownership, the case seems to have conducted by some pleading and then another judgment. So what we can say about the procedure really just comes down to this. The possessory and the proprietary were treated as separate issues, and the identities of claimant and defendant seem to have changed depending on the type of the issue and the question brought before the court. With the possessory issue, the monks were the plaintiffs and Hugh the defendant, and the roles were reversed when we turned to the proprietary question.
So we have, in a sense, we have a distinction in effect between possessory and proprietary, but that precise language isn't being used.
That's right. The precise language is not being used. We have other charters showing this similar distinction, which talk about the question of jus, which means right, when dealing with what we would identify as the proprietary issue, and that may be distinguished from a complaint or something about violence or possession. But no, we don't have the explicit language of possessory versus proprietary.
Are there any particularly interesting arguments that we know of having been made in court?
Well, the arguments worth noting in this case actually come from the court itself. And by court here, I mean the people who made up the court, which I'll come to a bit later. If we think about the possessory side of the case, the court explained its decision against Hugh on two grounds. The first was that Hugh ought to return everything that he had seized from the monks before the trial, and the language used here is ante placitum, and that he ought to pay a fine. Then the second rationale that the court gave was that seizure of the monks' property was itself wrong because he did not make a complaint of his own about the monks prior to taking their land and collecting resources from it. Now, what's so interesting about this decision on the possessory issue, is that we can locate and trace the development of each of these arguments in Western France starting from about the 1040s. The first argument looks a lot like the canonical precursors to the actio spolii and the principle spoliatus ante omnia restituendis, which just means that someone who has been despoiled or dispossessed must have those things restored to him before anything else can happen, i.e. before a trial. And we know that churchmen from this region were familiar with their pseudo-Isidore, which is where a lot of these provisions come, and were citing canons about spoliation in correspondence to each other and to lay figures. The second argument, which is that Hugh should first have made a complaint before seizing goods from the contested property. The second argument starts appearing in judgments made in the courts of the Counts of Anjou from about the 1040s. And we know that the Counts of Blois sometimes explicitly referred to earlier judgments made by the Angevin court. So we have a possible case to be made here that there's some circulation of what we would call more customary ideas. So that's really where the interesting arguments are, is we can trace the circulation of different ideas and the interplay between canonical and customary ideas.
That's really interesting, because one of the other cases that we look at from England, from Durham in 1088, is making exactly the same sort of distinctions, and again involving churchmen. Do we know anything about how the judgment is made?
No, is the short answer. The charter recording this case simply says it was judged that, so we don't even know who was responsible for the judgment. I think the passive construction here is, you know, much more could be said about it instead of identifying a specific person or group of people responsible for judgment, but that would be a separate issue altogether. The witnesses in the charter do include figures such as the Countess's seneschal and a figure intriguingly named Robert Legus Doctor, teacher of law. He's sometimes Robert Legus Doctus, so learned in law. But we don't know what role, if any, these figures played in the judgment.
And what's the outcome of the case?
Judgment went against Hugh on both the possessory and the proprietary sides of the case. We have no evidence that this particular case or issue was reopened, but we do know that Hugh de Chateaudun and the monks of Marmoutier would have a rather fractious relationship into the early 12th century.
Thanks. That's a really interesting case, both because of the sort of issues arising and the categorizations arising, but also because it's clearly a case which is part of a longer set of disputes, some sort of continuing conflict.